Until 1947, the official name of the U.S. government's central military agency was the War Department. After a two-year interim brand with the clunky name National Military Establishment, it was renamed the Department of Defense in 1949. As it happened, that was the same year when Orwell's dystopian novel 1984 appeared, telling an always-at-war totalitarian regime with double-speak slogans that included "War is peace." Today, the U.S. Department of Defense remains an appropriately capitalized proper noun, but the department's official name doesn't make it true. To call its massive and escalating budget a defense budget is nothing less than internalized corruption of language that undermines capacities to think clearly and talk straight. While such corroded language can't be blamed for the existence of sloppy thinking and degraded discourse, it regularly facilitates sloppy thinking and degraded discourse. Let's blow away the linguistic fog. The Pentagon budget is not a defense budget, it's a war budget. Midstream.
In the West Bank, the Israeli occupation forces face a real challenge in the city and camp of Jenin, up north of the city, where the Israeli aggression is being met with the form of resistance that scares Israel the most: live bullets and homemade Molotov instead of the good old rocks. The last of these clashes occurred at dawn last Monday when the occupation forces infiltrated to arrest a Palestinian young man, but an armed clash erupted, resulting in the martyrdom of five Palestinians. Activists in the camp made their stand very clear as they announced that resistance fighters from all factions are ready to clash with the Israeli army whenever they storm their camp. Since September 6, the West Bank and Gaza Strip have gone through daily confrontations and clashes between Palestinian natives and the Israeli occupation after the heroic escape of the six Palestinian detainees from the Gilboa prison. In the city of Jenin in the northern West Bank, in retaliation to the continuous Israeli aggression, dozens of shootings targeted Al Jalama checkpoint, homemade bombs were thrown, and bullets targeted an Israeli military occupation camp in the Mount Gerizim in Nablus. Also, dozens of clashes involved stones and Molotov cocktails took place in different parts of the West Bank. Anger mounted in the Palestinian streets after Israel recaptured and tortured four of the hero detainees, especially Zakaria Zubaydi, the former commander of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, who ended up with a fracture in the face due to the Israeli brutality. All Palestinian factions praised the escalated confrontations in Al-Quds and the West Bank, considering them as the only option to force Israel to end its violations against the Palestinian natives and those illegally held as captives in Israeli detention centers. Meanwhile, former commander of the Jenin unit in the occupation army, Yair Falau, confirmed that the city of Jenin and its camp still houses the nucleus of the Palestinian resistance in the occupied territories. This statement comes 20 years after the invasion carried out by the occupation army against the city and the West Bank under the name of the Defensive Wall. Falau suggested that the occupation army may carry out Operation Defensive Wall 2 within 6 months to a year if the situation continues as it is in Jenin. Yes, there is no comparison between the capabilities of the Israeli occupation forces and those of the resistance. But the will of the people and resistance fighters who have been going through hard times cannot be broken. They do not fear any threat. The Israeli army might be ready to storm the camp, awaiting a political decision, yet the resistance fighters in the camp will make them pay for it. Any price, no matter how low it is, will shake the Bennett government. This army cannot stand the killing of one or two of its occupation soldiers. Go figure what happens if scores of them start falling. The world has witnessed in front row seats the current generation in the occupied territories defending Palestine. Natives of Al-Quds and Jenin camp do not have any fears and are ready for any Israeli aggression. The proof is that they daily go to the Al-Jalama checkpoint and clash with the occupation. They are not waiting for the occupation to storm the camp. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Now, in the West Bank, the Israeli occupation forces face a real challenge in the city of Jenin in the north, where they are met with retaliatory live bullets rather than rocks, as in other areas when Zionists storm the rest of the West Bank. They are faced usually with stones being thrown at them by young men, but in Jenin, natives fire live ammunition at the occupation forces and armed clashes erupt. The last of these clashes occurred at dawn last Monday when the occupation forces penetrated to arrest a Palestinian youth and an armed clash erupted, resulting in the death of five Palestinians. It was not enough killings for Israelis that they later on Thursday morning, they killed a 30-year-old mother of four, Isra Huzaima, near Bab al-Silsila, a gate in occupied Al-Quds. Now, Isra, who is from southern Jenin, was accused without evidence by the Israeli occupation forces that she was trying to stab one of the soldiers. The city of Jenin and its camp still possesses the nucleus of Palestinian resistance in the occupied territories after 20 years of the invasion carried out by the occupation army on the city and the West Bank under the name of the Protective Fence. Now, this fence is falling apart, and Jenin will be the first to crush it. To discuss this issue with us from the occupied West Bank is Dr. Amal Wahdan, human rights advocate and member of the Global Gathering in Support of the Choice of Resistance. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Amal. Now, dozens of Palestinian gunmen roam the streets of the West Bank, especially the Jenin refugee camp in the northern West Bank, that they say that they are ready to repel any kind of Israeli aggression or invasion against the camp. And they even called for a joint operation. All factions inside the camp called for a joint operation for the first time in many, many years. It includes the military wings affiliated with the National Liberation Movement, Fatah, with the Islamic Resistance, Hamas, and with the Islamic Jihad as well. Now, clashes have led recently to the martyrdom of several Palestinian young men and women. How has that affected the morale of the people inside of the camp?
Thank you, Marwa, for having me. Of course, it's affecting the morale of the people in Jenin, and it's not only Jenin. It's affecting the people of Palestine inside and outside the occupied territories. So any defiance for the Israeli occupation army and forces is actually a unifying stance by all the people and packed by all the people. Jenin refugee camp is considered to be liberated, as we call it, as the militants from the joint operation room is calling it, because the Israelis cannot enter the camp and cannot go with military forces to arrest anybody within the camp, even in the surrounding villages of Jenin. Any entrance or any insurgent by the Israeli military forces is going to be confronted with joint operation room, with joint militants from different Palestinian resistance groups to fight these Israelis. So it's not something that is going to be away by the Israeli wishes or even by any insurgent by the Israeli military forces. It's going to be defied, it's going to be resisted, and it's going to be actually causing them lots of casualties if they dare to enter the camp or to enter any of the villages.
Well, Dr. Amar, we heard from a former commander of the Jenin unit in the occupation army. He said his name is Yad Flau, and he confirmed that the city of Jenin and its camp, it still possesses the nucleus of the resistance of the occupied territories in occupied Palestine. And he somehow threatened that there will be a new defensive war. He called it Operation Defensive World 2. Might happen again, similar to the one that happened in 2002, within 6 months to a year, if the situation continues as is in Jenin camp. Now, is this just cheap talk by this Falau person, or actually, because he's expected to be soon the commander of the Golani brigade in the army, or is Israel actually ready to commit a new genocide?
Well, committing genocide is there. The pattern is the process of this colonial apartheid entity since day one, even before 1948. So we wouldn't be surprised if they carry on any genocide against any of the Palestinian communities in the West Bank or Jerusalem. But the thing is, if we want to compare what happened 20 years ago and now in terms of accumulation of power, accumulation of willingness to defy the Israelis, even in the ability of the militants to fight the Israeli, Israeli insurgents or invasion, and if we compare what happened to the Israeli side after 20 years, we can see that the balance of power now is weighing towards the Palestinian resistance, the Palestinian militant.
Well, observers of the conditions of Jenin camp and Al-Quds are believing that the Jenin camp right now looks a lot like the besieged Gaza Strip, which the Israeli army is unable to invade, just like you said right now. Now, reports suggest that the resistance fighters from different areas of the West Bank actually arrived into Jenin camp in trying to prevent the invasion and preparing for a battle against the Israeli enemy. What are the odds of a joint Gaza/occupied territories operation in the event that Israel actually goes and invades Jenin camp, for example?
Well, that's the thing. If they dare to invade the Jenin refugee camp, I am sure that the resistance in Gaza will also stand up with Jenin and the rest of the West Bank as well. Remember that we still have the popular resistance everywhere, mm-hmm. and we witnessed what happened in Beit Anan, Jerusalem, over a week ago when they invaded one of the villages in Jerusalem. And the militants stood up for them. Of course, they were more in numbers, and it cost us two martyrs, actually. But at the end, the will of the people to resist the occupation is increasing and is accelerating.
That brings to mind a very important question, since we have one more minute left. How do you think the PA, the Palestinian Authority, will deal in the situation in case there is an escalation inside of Jenin and the popular resistance goes up, stands in the face of the occupation?
Actually, Al-Aqsa Brigades had chosen their side. They're with the resistance, and they are together with the other factions in the military operation room. So the PA has no choice except to stand by the resistance. Otherwise, it will be looking, it will look very bad in front of the eyes of the people, of the Palestinians here. They do not have any choice except to support the resistance, to support their Aqsab Brigade.
Well, so, in hopes that...
That's the national stance that they should take if they want to stay in power a little bit longer.
Thank you very much, Dr. Amal Wahdan, human rights advocate and member of the Global Gathering in support of the choice of the resistance, for being with us. And whether Palestine resists or not, we stand by the side of Palestine and by the right to defend their own soil and their liberties. Now, please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about how Bahrain opened a new Israeli embassy and how the population, the public, is revolting against it.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
In the first official visit by an Israeli minister, Israeli Foreign Minister Yair Lapid inaugurated the Israeli embassy in Manama and met the Bahraini King Hamad bin Isa Al Khalifa. Now, the official Bahraini news agency reported that King Hamad reviewed with Lapid the course of bilateral relations and the steps that contribute to the strengthening areas of cooperation between the two countries in light of the signing of the Declaration of Support for Peace and the Abraham Accord Agreement. Yes. He said peace, while Palestine just held several different funeral processions last week alone for the natives that were killed by the occupation's bullets. No shame whatsoever. The visit of the Israeli Foreign Minister Yair Lapid to Bahrain can be summed up in one word: treason. This is how the Bahraini people feel about it, and how every Arab, Muslim, and free soul on this planet actually feels. No king, emir, or president will ever be able to remove Palestine from the hearts and minds of the people, and they will all never wash the stain of this crime from their hands. Al-Khalifa regime betrays Palestine in this following report.
Demonstrations against normalization continue in Bahrain, coinciding with the visit of the Israeli entity's foreign minister Yair Lapid, voicing their refusal to open an Israeli embassy on their soil. The Bahraini security forces had suppressed similar demonstrations in the capital, Manama, and in several cities after they roamed the streets condemning normalization during the past week. On the day of the visit, Bahraini National Initiative Against Normalization affirmed its complete rejection of normalization with the usurping entity. The initiative considered in a statement under the title No Welcome to the Occupying Criminal that Lapid's desecration of Bahrain's land comes in light of the strong rejection of the proud Bahraini people who remain loyal to their central cause, pointing out that the Palestinian cause is the compass of the conflict in the region and that the Israeli entity is a satanic seed that has been planted in the side of the Arab world to keep the latter in a state of permanent depletion, keeping it away from progress, development, and prosperity. The initiative called on the authorities of Bahrain to immediately stop slipping towards normalization, which constitutes a stab in the back of the Palestinian people and its active forces and its militant factions, calling on all groups of the Bahraini people to renew their rejection of this normalization with the enemy and to continue to stand by the Palestinian people and support them in order to liberate their land and establish their independent national state on their entire national territory with Al-Quds as their official capital. Meanwhile, all Palestinian factions and pro-resistance factions across the Arab and Islamic world condemned this act of normalization by the Bahraini rogue regime, summing up the visit of the Israeli Foreign Minister Yair Lapid to Bahrain in one word: treason. All the while, Bahrain's King Hamad bin Isa Al Khalifa blatantly considered that his country's normalization with the Israeli occupation entity is a, quote, historic achievement that contributes to advancing the peace and stability process in the Middle East, end quote. The king's brazen remarks came as Palestine held seven different funeral processions for natives killed by the occupation's bullets during the same week of the Israeli foreign minister's visit to his country to open the notorious embassy on Bahraini soil.
Now to discuss this issue with us from London is Mr. Ali Al-Fayez, Bahraini activist. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Al-Fayez. Now, rogue regimes in multiple Arab countries that had normalized ties with the Israeli entity are pinning their hopes on the U.S., eyeing to please Washington by this kind of normalization. The last of which was actually Bahrain, when it welcomed Israeli foreign minister, as we just saw in the report, Yair Lapid, who inaugurated an Israeli embassy in Manama and met with the Bahraini king, Hamad bin Isa al-Khalifa. Does the king not care whatsoever about the public sentiment in this matter? I mean, is he not concerned about his nation's security in any way possible?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Thank you for inviting me. Well, you just said that it's a rogue regime. The Al-Khalifa regime have no legitimacy whatsoever. And the king, so-called king, the ruler of Bahrain, is taking decision on behalf of himself and his family, not on behalf of the people. The people, is against the normalization of the Zionist entity. And our people have protested on the street for the past days, flagging the opposition to such step. Now, when we talk about security and stability, Al-Khalifa does not look at the stability of the country and security of Bahrain, but they look at the security of their regime, the Al-Khalifa ruling regime, and they believe it will be more secured with the relationship with this entity, the Zionist entity, as there is a step from the United States to leave Middle East soon.
Well, Mr. Al-Fayez, the February 14 Revolution Youth Coalition in Bahrain denounced the planned visit of the Israeli Foreign Minister Yair Lapid to Bahrain, holding the Bahraini regime responsible for the consequences of the visit. Now, the coalition also emphasized the need for all forms of resistance against normalization until the concluded normalization agreements are cancelled completely with the entity. Can this be understood as a mobilization for the first armed resistance in Bahrain? That's just me asking, because I read it and read it again, and I was like, well, this is new. What do you think?
Well, the leadership of Bahrain movement, Ayatollah Sheikh Isa Ahmed Qasim, decision until this moment is to stay peaceful. Now, this with regard to the democratic transformation that the opposition and the people of Bahrain demanded for the past 10 years, actually more than 10 years, but since the 14th of February revolution. Now, with the Zionist regime being in the picture and the equation, this could change the whole equation. But, you know, 14 of the coalition or other movement, they have always such option on the table, but they will not take it in a practice unless it's decided by Ayatollah Sheikh Isa Ahmed Qasim. We will resist politically, we will resist on the media, we will resist on the ground by protesting, but mobilization of armed resistance is a decision of Ayatollah Sheikh Isa Ahmed Qasim, and I would advise everyone to read his statements and to follow what he is saying, because he could take a decision if that's needed to secure Bahrain and the interest of this ummah, the Arabic and Islamic ummah.
Well, Palestine viewed this visit as an encouragement of Israeli crimes against its people. Mind you, on the same week which the visit actually happened, there were seven Palestinian natives that were killed with live bullets by the Israeli entity, one of which actually a 30-year-old mother of four in the occupied Al-Quds. I mean, after such humiliating normalization, what role do these puppet regimes think that they can play to protect Palestine, as they always say they are doing?
Well, that's a fake statement. They always say it change the direction of their agenda. Their agenda is to have a relationship with Israel the Zionist entity, the Zionist regime at this point of time, because the United States have almost reached a decision to withdraw from our region, the Middle East region. The ruler of Bahrain will last think about Palestine. He will never put that in his political calculation at all.
Well, Mr. Al-Fayez, on the outskirts of Manama, as you mentioned at the beginning of the interview, that protesters burned tires, they protested, they tried to voice their let's say they try to be as vocal as possible to say that they do not accept this kind of normalization, especially against the Al-Khalifa regime. We saw a hashtag on social media that says hashtag Bahrain rejects Zionists in Arabic. It was trending all week long. What do you think will be the role of the new Israeli embassy in Manama in the event the opposition decided to face off with the Bahraini regime to inverse this normalization? What can the embassy do when it has a foot inside of Manama?
Well, look, the anger is piling inside Bahrain. The people are very angry. They've been protesting for the past 3-4 days. A momentum that's going up high. And we believe the Israeli have come to Bahrain because Al-Khalifa regime needed extra support from United States and Britain to counter the people demand of democratic transformation. But the interest of the Zionist regime is to counter Iran as a growing power that lead the resistance in our region, in the Middle East region. Now, we hear many statements from Israeli officials as well as Bahraini officials that they will have a military and security ties, and this could lead to a conflict, could lead to make Bahrain as a conflict area. God forbid, if that happened, the Israeli will not be able to defend their ally, Al-Khalifa regime, because they can't defend themselves.
Well, this has to be seen, especially in the upcoming weeks when protests are being called upon by the Bahraini people and all activists around the world as well to protest against this decision by the Al-Khalifa regime in Bahrain. I want to thank you very much, Mr. Ali Al-Fayez, Bahraini activist, for joining us from London to talk about this issue. Thank you very much for your time. And thank you. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East Stream.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
in the limelight.
When the U.S. government allows exploitative real estate corporations to develop shoddy private developments to maximize profit and displace black residents, thousands are left without homes during a disaster, says Rashad Robinson, reporter, in an article titled, Hurricane Ida is Proof U.S. Systematic Racism Aggravates Effects of Climate Crisis. Stay tuned for more. With nearly 2 months left of this year's turbulent hurricane season, thousands of Louisianans are entering their sixth straight week without power following Hurricane Ida. Meanwhile, displaced residents in search of adequate shelter for their families are piling into any neighbor's homes that are still intact, some with up to 10 people in a single white trailer, destroying more of Louisiana's power grid than any other storm in the state's history. Hurricane Ida has left millions without homes or access to clean water during a pandemic. This destruction wasn't by simple happenstance or some sort of unpredictable anomaly. It was the direct result of the failure of political and corporate leaders in the U.S. year after year to build adequate infrastructure, implement equitable protections for relief, and provide black communities the same resources and protections afforded to wealthy white neighborhoods. We have seen this before, 16 years ago, nearly to the day when Hurricane Katrina decimated Louisiana. The U.S. government and corporations provided no support that the people of New Orleans needed as delays in relief and rescue left millions of residents without food, water, or shelter for weeks and severely undermined the economic stability of residents in the years since. Color of Change, the organization have led for last 11 years, was founded in 2005 in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. It was born in response to a profound realization in that moment. No one in power was nervous about disappearing black people and failing to meet the needs, not even that massive scale of suffering. There was no consequences for hurting black communities. Now, 16 years later, black people have built the kind of power that it takes to be heard. As a result of the work of the Movement for Racial Justice, we can now see how racial impact is more and more frequently part of the policy discussion when it comes to the problems Americans need to solve as a country. From climate disasters and a pandemic, to consumer protections to tax and education policy. But being a topic of conversation, whether in a government office or a corporate boardroom, is not enough. Americans do not yet have the power it takes to get the results they need when it comes to preventing events like Ida or COVID-19 from causing them more harm and forcing more sacrifices from them than other communities. When U.S. government allows exploitative real estate corporations to develop shoddy private developments to maximize profit and displace black residents, thousands are left without homes during a disaster. When elected leaders redirect vital infrastructure and health funds to already bloated, inept, and abusive police departments, health and emergency services cannot reach those in need during times of crises. Even with widespread organizing for reinvestment into black communities, corporations actively disrupt movements for collective power and change. Climate change and structural racism share something profound. They are both outcomes that corporations and politicians have manufactured for their own narrow purposes and profits. They also bring out the worst of corporate myth-making. Corporate leaders have pushed the sham of individual consumption reduction as the main solution to climate change, while it's apparent that reckless corporate overproduction, inefficiency, and willful neglect of responsibility, including an extensive history of exploiting black people, is the greatest contributor to climate change. Conservatives, including corporate leaders, have similarly tried to convince black people that racism is a matter of individual behavior rather than policies, systems, and structures designed to maintain white supremacy and privilege. Climate change and structural racism reinforce one another. Each makes the other stronger. We need to accept that racism is a climate change accelerator, and that climate change is a major racial impact and racial justice issue. And in both cases, unchecked corporate power is the biggest driver. Climate disasters aren't a simple misfortune. Their destruction derives from geographic segregation, generational poverty, and a lack of accountability from corporate powers and elected leaders who have siphoned resources from black communities from the start. Historic and current political decisions have placed black people directly in the initial zone of climate danger. From consistent faults in the emergency protocols in New Orleans, unlivable air quality for majority black neighborhoods in Detroit produced by Chrysler production plans, investing funds to police departments, and giving tax breaks to corporations, environmental racism is the direct result of those in power intentionally choosing to prioritize profits over the well-being of black communities. Corporations that have the means to ensure housing and substantial recovery for survivors of disaster but choose to do nothing are attacking black communities, no matter what their slick advertisements featuring black people may say. To understand the impact of climate change and refuse to implement legislative regulations to halt its impact is another form of attack on black communities. Individuals around the U.S. are showing up for survivors via fundraising, mutual aid, and neighborly support. Inaction from corporate powers and harmful policies implemented by lawmakers have led to New York City, one of the wealthiest cities in the world, being entirely unprepared for mass flooding in subway systems and homes as a result of Hurricane Ida. Both private corporations and public elected officials have a responsibility not only to provide the necessary relief, but to prevent this kind of negligence from causing more damage in the future. Last year, corporations of all kinds publicly claimed to care about racial justice. But the fact is, moments like these let us know which corporations are actually willing to put their money where their values are. Energy providers like Entergy and hospitality companies like Hyatt have an opportunity to uphold their commitments to justice and directly help those displaced in Louisiana. If they claim to care about black lives, they too must support black livelihood and well-being. Forcing black communities to bear the brunt of climate disasters disproportionately is not only unjust, but will only postpone the moment at which we realize that climate change is an issue that affects Americans all and will drastically impact their shared fate. Thank you.
chair defends the Iranian combatants.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
Talking Iran and foreign policy, the JCPOA was a word hard to miss out. It got everyone riled up, both in 2015 when it was signed and in 2018 when the U.S. pulled out. But then in March 2021, Iran signed a 25-year strategic treaty with China. And now it has acceded as full member to the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Its request for an upgrade from observer member was accepted in September, after a wait of some 15 years. That's hardly a coincidence. Iran has foreseen the importance of balancing its foreign policy concessions and gains by extending diplomatic and trade ties eastward. You can never know the result of an exam for sure, but you do your best to prepare. And Iranian politicians of the new government seem pretty satisfied with their change of foreign policy direction leaning more eastwards. Time will tell. But pundits' predictions are also pretty reliable. So to hear those, stay with me, Leila Farahmandzi, on Iran Today. The country's overall foreign policy strategy will remain the same. That is because foreign policy objectives are generally decided at the Supreme National Security Council, SNSC, where just half of its 10 members are represented by the president and his cabinet members. And the present government is not abandoning what has been set in motion before. It's just adopting a policy of pivot to the east rather than the west by watering seeds sown and casting a firm net wider. Let's see what our guest thinks of this new tendency and how different he finds it from the former government's foreign policy direction. Mr. Shojaian is an analyst and journalist at Jama Jam Daily, which means he's in the thick of current affairs. He received us at the newspaper headquarters where he shared his thoughts.
Well, obviously, the former government and those that came before it, more attention was paid to foreign policy, especially trans-regional issues. But as Mr. Raisi's government takes office, it appears that they don't want to employ the same formula, as it didn't bring any noticeable result for the country. Therefore, by appointing Mr. Amir Abdullahian as Iran's foreign minister, who the parliament rightfully voted for, Mr. Raisi is pursuing bilateral and multilateral relations with different countries.
Now, what's called for prioritizing regional and Asian ties over ultra-regional ties looking west? For one, the West hasn't been a reliable partner, at least where the United States has come into the equation, primarily since 2018. And it does come into the equation. Second, it's not a good idea to put all your eggs in one basket. An accusation principalists now in power have been bombarding the former moderate government with. I give you Mr. Barati, international group leader of Iran's think tank associations network.
Why is it more important to expand regional ties rather than ultra-regional ties, if you agree it is?
Economic diplomacy, in my view, is very important. As it has been discussed in both governments, the same is true for Mr. Raisi's government. But more important is whether this approach is based on real opportunities or only a perceived sense of opportunity, which takes time to translate into reality. In Mr. Raisi's government, what Mr. Amir Abdullahian is mentioning is closer to reality. For one thing, the focus is directed at neighboring countries. They are Iran's markets. Even under the most severe economic sanctions, we maintained our economic transactions with countries like Iraq and Afghanistan.
This is not to say the West will be excluded from the equation. That would depend on how the Vienna talks go, however. Russia, one of the two major players in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the other being China, is replacing Germany as Iran's European trade partner for technical equipment.
For pundit opinion, I've come to Parliament, one of the three powers in the country to which new foreign policy decisions have to be announced for approval. And I'll be talking to the National Security Committee spokesman. What economic potentials do our neighbors have which have been forgotten so far?
Iran has 15 neighbors. This means that we have independent trade opportunities with at least 15 countries. If we take into account the second layer of Iran's neighbors, the opportunities would be much more than this. There's a 500 million strong market around Iran. This creates a great opportunity for Iranian products. Statistically speaking, the region is earning $1.2 trillion in foreign trade. But Iran's share in the figure is about some 2%. In our opinion, that could be greatly improved.
The UAE has been challenging Iran, so to speak, and competing to become an international transit hub. Now, this is while Iran is both on the east-west and north-south transit corridors. Actually, while Iran meets the high seas in the south, say directly with its Chabahar port, just at the Caspian Sea in the north, it borders five countries.
Iran is trying to break the sanctions by changing its foreign policy leanings. Do you think it's going to work, or do you see us in the end coming to terms with Western powers?
Iran is located at the center of China's BRIC. Also, the north-to-south corridor passes through Iran to reach India's western ports and connect them to North Asia. Furthermore, Iran has a unique position as it connects to Europe through Turkey, Azerbaijan and Armenia. At the same time, Iran is cooperating with resistance countries like Iraq, Syria and Lebanon, which is creating a new route connecting Iran to the Mediterranean Sea. These all attest to Iran's unique geographical position.
The Caspian Sea, which is the world's largest lake, but still a lake, has an area of 380,000 square kilometers and 6,500 kilometers of coastline. And as it expands on the borders of several countries, it includes several major transportation corridors, such as the North-South Corridor, the Caspian-Black Sea Corridor, and Trans-Caspian Corridor, while playing a pivotal role in other new routes and emerging corridors. Abdullah Jafari, Director of International Agreements in the Ports and Maritime Organization, PMO, of Iran, pointed to the existence of more than 20 international ports and terminals in the Caspian littoral states. He specified, Caspian littoral ports with a total operating capacity of about 140 million tons and having 300 active vessels, including the Russian fleet with 150 vessels, the Iranian fleet with 60 vessels, and three other countries with a total of 90 vessels, have a high capacity to develop maritime trade relations in the region. Iran is focusing on economic multilateralism, and its trade strategy has been shaped by three drivers: the desire to reduce dependency on Western sources of technology as well as promote trade among Islamic nations, technocratic priorities, say securing modern technologies and investments for key industries such as petroleum, telecom, automotive, and the desire to reduce the country's vulnerability to external sanctions by a resistance economy. The former administration set plenty on a resistance economy, and the present government insists on taking that forward.
The principle that the government of the Islamic Republic of Iran is pursuing is that negotiation and diplomacy should be focused on reaching a specific result, which in my opinion will not happen without addressing past mistakes. The JCPOA is an agreement that has been violated by the US once by simply walking out of it. If no effort is made to address this shortcoming, if the US government and other signatories to the deal don't propose a mechanism to solve this problem and won't offer any guarantees about it, a possible new deal wouldn't be that effective at all.
What do you think of Iran's new foreign policy, or leaning, rather?
The newly formed 13th government has introduced its foreign policy goals. Amongst other things, it announced that it will focus on Iran's neighbors and would emphasize strengthening the country's economic diplomacy. Also on the new government's foreign policy agenda is taking a new look at Asian powers and at the same time pursuing balanced diplomacy based on which Iran would establish balanced relationships with Asian, European, African and American countries.
For a short break. We'll be back in no time.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
A sign business is important to this administration is that President Raisi made his first campaign event a meeting with the chiefs of the Chamber of Commerce. Now, having a resistance economy is to promote domestic capacity building, including expanding Iran's export potential. It absolutely does not mean isolating the country from the global economy. In fact, from the JCPOA signing to upgrading to permanent member with the Shanghai Organization, Iran's efforts have been to join up with at least one economic bloc. Talking of blocs, the geopolitical look of the world is in transition. We'll shortly be hearing more on blocs and where Iran finds itself and where other countries find themselves in relation to Iran. Also, we'll talk of what's led to the present trade strategy. There's plenty more to be said and yet more to come up. But what there's room for today, I shall leave for after a quick media review, so do stay tuned to see what other outlets have to say.
All right. Let's check out some other news outlets' take on Raisi's administration and foreign policies. Tehran Times headline reads, "Raisi not seeking to limit foreign policy dynamism," MP says. The article continues, "The spokesman for the President's Board of the Iranian Parliament says, contrary to the claim of some people, the Raisi administration does not seek to limit foreign policy dynamism and the nuclear negotiations with the hope of revitalizing the 2015 nuclear deal will be pursued based on national dignity." In his remarks during the election campaign, President Ebrahim Raisi explicitly stated that the way he and his administration will solve the country's problems is different from the previous administration. The MP stated that since Raisi and many of his supporters are seriously critical of Rouhani's approach to running the country, which has led to many current problems, a new approach should naturally be taken in various areas in regards to negotiations. And here's the headline for Mehr News. It reads, "Iran's foreign policy economy not to be tied to JCPOA." The article continues, "The FM spoke about the negotiations on reviving the JCPOA, saying negotiations should be beneficial for the Iranian nation. In the meetings I had, I said that we would not run away from the negotiations and we would accept it, but we need a reasonable amount of time to prepare. We will not tie the country's foreign policy and economy to negotiations and the JCPOA. The government has an economic development plan. If the negotiation is successful, it will be a catalyst for an economic development plan. But if the negotiations do not reach the desired results and the other parties do not want to show their true intention and will, as they claim, we will not wait for negotiations." Now, here's the headline for foreign policy. It reads, "An overview of Amir Abdullahian's intensive talks in New York." The article continues, new Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian and his diplomatic team spent 5 intensive working days in New York to elaborate on Iran's new foreign policy approaches. Amir Abdullahian held about 50 meetings with counterparts and officials from international institutions on the sidelines of the annual UN General Assembly meeting. His meetings were so intense and frequent that he himself told IRNA before leaving New York that indeed, if it were possible for me to stay in New York for another 2 or 3 days, some of the meetings will still be scheduled. I would not be able to make these appointments due to time constraints. And we followed up on some of them over the phone and on the sidelines of the meeting. Many countries wanted to hear about the policy of the new Iranian administration from its chief diplomat in order to regulate their relations on that basis and then decide. All right, I'm going to give the floor back to Leila to hear about the rest of our narrative on the story.
A combination of various factors has generated a trade strategy, which was formulated in 2019. The plan accounts for targeted import substitution and an expansion of trade with immediate neighbors, including Russia and the Eurasian Economic Union, EEU. The objective was to double the value of exports sent to 15 immediate neighbors by March 2022, while reducing reliance on Western sources of technology by diversifying import sources.
The approach of balanced diplomacy, which is being followed in the 13th government and is also accepted in the parliament, is not a denial of the West. It simply means that every country or geographical region is given opportunities by Iran according to how much they are willing to cooperate with Tehran. Right now, the opportunity for cooperation between Iran and Asian countries is greater than ever.
To generate its needed foreign direct investment, Iran later expressed the desire to enter into long-term strategic partnership agreements with China and Russia. Be it a change of direction in foreign policy or implementing plans that were already in place, the Raisi government is not in for an easy ride, but the horizon provides happy motivation.
China has made great strides in the field of commercialized technologies, changing from a copycat in the field of technology to an innovator and owner of the technology. Take 5G telecom tech, for example, an advanced technology that was the basis of China's dispute with the US. This has made working with China an immense asset. Those who work with China say the country is an ocean of equipment and technology, and there's nothing you're after that you won't find in there. Russia is also advanced in military matters, including aerospace technology.
Unfortunately, in recent years, the U.S. government and the White House have made every effort to disrupt Iran's diplomatic relations in various ways. We believe that this has happened at times if we have a realistic view of this issue. But our friends in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, the cabinet, and the government are not sitting idle, and good things will definitely happen. This includes strengthening the axis of resistance, which today has become an integral part of the region.
Talking of economic multilateralism and broader relations with the world, particularly neighboring countries, this was jump-started importantly by Iran's ascension to the SCO. Addressing the 21st SCO summit in Dushanbe, the Tajik capital, Ayatollah Raisi, who assumed office on the 3rd of August 2021, said, "The combination of the Eurasia and One Road, One Belt initiatives can be an objective realization of this approach and the vast potential of the Islamic Republic of Iran in terms of geopolitics, population, energy, transportation, human resources. And most importantly, spirituality, culture, and civilization can cause a significant stimulus to this outlook." As for who will find itself where in relation to Iran, the West doesn't appear happy about its slot, its slimming slot. Having failed to hold up their end of the bargain with the JCPOA or nuclear deal in lifting sanctions off Iran and giving its economy a boost, the West has had to sit back and watch as Iran pivots eastwardly. And the Iran-China 25-year cooperation program, Western powers have been trying to portray as a win-loss accord, with Iran at the losing end. They do realize that agreement will diffuse the impact of U.S. embargoes and the need for Iran to hold on to Europe for that. In fact, the New York Times reported that the Iran-China deal covering a quarter of a century is a big blow to the hostile maximum pressure of the Trump administration against Iran, and that it can become a new center of tensions between the U.S. and China.
The developments that have been taking place in recent years have been in the field of economics. That is, we are seeing sweeping changes in the international economy. We are witnessing China's increasing power and access to advanced technologies. This shift in economic power from